This is The Takeaway for Thursday, May 5th, 2016.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. Thanks so much for listening, and let's clear something up right now.
In Iran,
we don't have homosexuals like in your country. We don't have that in our country.
It was 2007 when then-President of Iran Mahmoud Ahmadinejad stood before the student body at Columbia University and insisted that there was no homosexuality in Iran. The speech was a test of the college's belief in free speech. The campus was sharply divided over whether the Iranian president should speak at all, but when he did, his bizarre candor revealed something worth knowing about the then leadership of Iran. This understanding is perhaps why there has been so much change in Iran and why the U.S. relationship with Iran has changed. But colleges seem to have a difficult time with free speech these days, something President Obama addressed at a talk at the University of Iowa.
I've heard some college campuses where they don't want to have a guest speaker who is too conservative, or they don't want to read a book if it has language that is offensive to African Americans. Anybody who comes to speak to you and you disagree with, you should have an argument with them. But you shouldn't silence them by saying you can't come because, you know, I'm too sensitive to hear what you have to say.
The president was objecting to what he called coddling of oversensitive youth and a silencing of voices. And if silenced means being disinvited by a school after being asked to speak, then these people have been silenced. Condoleezza Rice, former Secretary of State, Christine Lagarde, head of the International Monetary Fund, and Ray Kelly, former New York City police chief. When the issue is racism, Israel and Palestine, abortion or religion, the hot buttons on campus get pushed and controversy can mean events get canceled. How does this happen and who defends free speech on college campuses? Mark Landy is a professor of political science at Boston College. John Corvino is a professor and chair of the philosophy department at Wayne State University. Is there still an ethos of free speech on campuses today? Professor Landy is not so sure.
I couldn't be less satisfied at the moment. I've been in higher education all my life, and the change that's taken place from an atmosphere of challenge of students, of faculty, to an atmosphere where the greatest concern seems to be that people shouldn't get upset. Well, of course you should get upset at a university.
Professor Corvino, do you think students and administrators at colleges are inclined to be coddled in the ways in which free speech issues are resolved, as President Obama once said?
I think that might be a little bit strong, and I think a lot depends on the circumstances. Professor Landy is right that students ought to be challenged, but some of this conversation that we're having about, you know, how much comfort do we need to promote? How much pressure do we need to put forth? I mean, that's all part of the free speech ethos on campus. So I think that actually is still healthy, and the fact that campuses are having this kind of conversation is evidence of that.
Although, was that your first response when you were told that you were disinvited to the campus at Providence College?
Well, I mean, again, like I said, every situation is unique. But here's what happened there. A group of nine different departments invited me to speak. An administrator summarily just decided, no, we're going to disinvite him. He just cited some policy that, in fact, wasn't in place on the campus. And as a result of that, the Faculty Senate, the students, everybody started getting together and talking about why that was wrong. And eventually I was invited to speak. So there we saw actually the process ultimately working out.
Although you're an unusual case, a lot of times the speaker decides, forget about it, this is ridiculous, and they decide to go away, and the silencing is what the net effect is, Professor Corvino.
Well, I mean, if you want to call that silencing, so I think that disinviting somebody is a strong action. It should not be taken lightly. I think there are very rare circumstances where a person who's been duly invited ought to be disinvited. But when a person is invited and there's pushback to that and the person says, well, hey, I just don't want to do this, that's the person's free decision as well.
See, I have a somewhat different outlook. I don't view the case that John's describing in such a positive light. It seems to me that there is very, very little room for pushback when a speaker is invited. I mean, there really has to be, I think, some palpable evidence that the speaker is going to incite trouble or is so far outside civil discourse. It seems to me as long as the speaker can be counted on to take part in relatively civil discourse, there's no room for pushback. People don't have to come.
What was your experience and your issue, Mark Landy, that most disturbed you here?
Yeah, I think the fact that this would even go to the faculty senate, that this was somehow that I mean, I don't know Professor Corvino, but he sounds like a reasonable fellow. Therefore, he passes the test of who can speak at a university. And the fact that there are all these procedures in place to take issue with an invitation to a speaker is really evidence of the closing of the university's mind.
Why did you have to defend the decision to invite Condoleezza Rice to your campus?
Yeah, well, okay, so there was a complication there because she was both being offered an honorary degree and being invited to speak. And so various members of the opposition to inviting Secretary of State Rice took different positions. I could at least understand a pushback about having her receive an honorary degree. That's something of an open question, although she was the sitting Secretary of State and the most prominent Black woman in America. I have to say, in our case, that although it received an enormous amount of publicity and there was a lot of discord on campus, our administration was absolutely forthright. There was no procedure for reconsidering Secretary of State Rice. So I was very proud of our president and our administration for simply sticking up. I was disappointed that a lot of faculty felt they had to make a gesture. They turned their back on Secretary Rice when she spoke. But that's within their rights.
Professor Covino, what was your issue?
At Providence College?
Yes.
Well, I speak on gay rights issues. Providence College is a Catholic university, and administration there was worried that didn't fit with the Catholic values of the university to have me speak. But again, I was duly invited by a group of 9 different units or departments. There should have been more speech going on there before they made that decision.
To both of you, is there an ethos, a counter ethos, perhaps, among young people who grew up with Facebook and sort of digital social media that encourages their own beliefs and allows them to live a little more in a bubble than perhaps the three of us did growing up, that young people have a set of blinders on regarding hot button and touchy issues, and that particularly among liberal college students, that there's a lack of tolerance for other viewpoints on college campuses, and that's partly what we're seeing here. Professor Corvino?
I think it's certainly a danger. I mean, when people are accustomed to expressing their views in sound bites in controlled environments like Facebook or, you know, Twitter, where they can control their followers and things like that, there's the danger of not being accustomed to the kind of healthy dialogue. That's yet another reason why we at universities, when we have this opportunity, have a real responsibility to try to draw people out of that and say, look, we need to have a larger conversation here. I also think that can be overset or overemphasized. I mean, these kinds of platforms have also enabled people in some cases to be able to share differing views. I mean, I have friends across the political spectrum on my Facebook page. They, you know, disagree sharply on certain issues, and sometimes that can be a healthy exercise of free speech.
Professor Landy?
Yeah, I finally have something really cheerful to say, which is that the vast bulk of college students that I, at least the ones that I deal with, are remarkably open-minded. And this furor has really been created, I think, by, first of all, relatively small groups of activist students who do not represent the modal student. And more insidiously, the proliferation of a bureaucracy on our campuses their careers depend on their ability to be very active in controlling speech. They're there initially to deal with hate speech, but of course there isn't that much hate speech on a lot of these campuses, so they look to expand their portfolio. There's too much administration on our campuses and not enough freedom.
You think there's a police, speech police on campus who are
yes.
responsible for hate speech and, you know, use of inappropriate racial language?
Yes. Yes. There is a bureaucracy whose professional advancement depends on really finding cases to deal with. And so they expand their portfolios, and I dare say they often inspire students to create issues that would, in the normal course of things, would never arise.
Professor Corvino?
Once again, I worry that that might be overstated. I mean, certainly there are people who expand the notion of hate speech way too far, that anything, you know, that makes them uncomfortable that they disagree with suddenly becomes hate speech. You know, there are thin-skinned people in every element of society. But I also think that, you know, some of what we're referring to here as pushback, as criticism, is yet a further example of people exercising their free speech. When people say things that are insensitive, that marginalize people on campuses, and other people call that out, that's a healthy exercise of free speech as well.
John Corvino is professor and chair of the philosophy department at Wayne State University. Mark Landy is professor of political science at Boston College. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks, John.
This is Salita in Girdwood, Alaska. I attended Xavier University in Cincinnati, Ohio. Both the student body and most of the city of Cincinnati definitely tended towards a conservative, Christian, right-wing, and Republican, and I am none of those things. However, I always felt that my opinions were not only welcomed, but also encouraged and respected by faculty and students. Productive and thoughtful dialogue and sometimes robust debate were the values that really enriched the educational experience and kept it lively and valuable.
McKinney, Texas shared, I went to an incredibly conservative university, but because of the way I was raised and the confidence I had in my own beliefs, I never felt I had to censor or hide my opinions about things. It actually brought people forward who were in agreement but hadn't felt comfortable sharing. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or comment at thetakeaway.org. Later this hour, America's hidden history told in awkward parent-teacher conferences. 18-year-old Machi Demoriaku had a 91 average when she brought her parents in for conference.
It was still highly embarrassing because I'm African and I'm Nigerian, and Nigerian parents do a lot of annoying, embarrassing stuff.
Machi is making a career out of telling her first-generation Nigerian-American stories, and a lot of the stories involve her very traditional parents.
They're very strong, proud people. That they have, like, this certain tradition that they go by, and it stays the same. Like, there's no way in changing it.
So you don't like that about it?
I love it, and then there's some times where I kind of disengage myself from it. Till today, I'm, like, picking colleges for performing arts, and my aunts and uncles will go ahead and tell my dad or my mom, like, this girl is not doing what is good for herself, what is good for everybody else, and that kind of, like, gets me upset because I want to do what's good for me.
First Generation America and its Teenage Declarations of Independence. That's coming up here on The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society, funding research so patients do more than survive, they live their lives. Learn more at lls.org.
Turkey's President Recep Erdogan is maybe throwing in the towel on a decade of trying to become a regional power. Erdogan has forced his hand-picked Prime Minister, Ahmet Davutoğlu, to stand down later this month. The Syrian migrant crisis, an escalating conflict with PKK Kurdish rebels, as well as a perceived failure to have any influence over events in the Syrian civil war, have all brought a chapter of Turkish history to a close. Soner Çayaptay is director of the Turkish Research Program at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. Soner, is this an ideological conflict that Erdogan is having?
Not at all. I think this shows personalization of power in Turkey, a very unfortunate trend in one of the oldest democracies in the Middle East. And for that purpose, a country which has been a multi-party democracy since 1950, I think is now seeing the hollowing out of all institutions and personalization of power in the hands of Turkish President Erdogan. Davutoğlu was seen as a very compliant prime minister. You could not be more compliant than him, but I think it looks like Erdogan wants someone who is basically a no-name and will do everything that he wants as head of government, that is, head of prime minister, completely subservient to Erdogan, who is head of state. This shows to me that Erdogan is not only the head of state in Turkey, which is his official title, but he's also the head of government now de facto. He will handpick the next head of the ruling party as well as the next head of government. So he's head of state, head of government, head of ruling party, head of everything in Turkey. Complete personalization of power in his hands seems to be on the way.
And given that the prime minister was seen as someone who was compliant, and even that didn't work out, does he have a constituency? Is he well known in the country? Is he likely to take his dismissal and make some sort of political opposition out of it?
Unfortunately for himself, the prime minister has no constituency whatsoever. He is an academic who is basically seen as someone with some scholarly credentials who came to power as a foreign policy expert. He's actually the architect of Turkey's failed Syria policy, but ironically, that policy was backed up by Erdogan when Davutoğlu, the prime minister, executed it. So I think another way of looking at this resignation mandated by Erdogan is that Erdogan maybe wants to move away some of his failures in Syria, which have exposed Turkey to great risks, threats, terrorist attacks, as well as many enemies in Syria from the Assad regime to the Russian government, that maybe this is how he's trying to distance himself from some of his failures by firing the prime minister.
Is the nation more widely aware of the escalation against Kurdish rebels in the east of the country?
If you live in Turkey, there's no way you won't be aware of the many threats, not only fighting against the PKK in the southeast, but also the threats that are looming. Turkey had more suicide bomb attacks, unfortunately, in the last few months than it has ever had in its entire history. Hundreds of people have been killed as a result of attacks caused by ISIL or PKK, and some even have been connected to the Assad regime. This was a foreign policy in Syria and the Middle East executed by Davutoğlu and Erdogan that was supposed to make Turkey a Middle East star. It has not only failed to make that, but also exposed the country to huge risks.
But Soner, Erdogan is not in a position now to back away from Syria. He's stuck in the middle of this conflict, and I'm just wondering what kind of movement is even possible for him now.
One movement is that the whole Davutoğlu foreign policy doctrine supported by Erdogan was based on the premise that Turkey could become a Middle East power when and if it broke with Washington and with its traditional Western allies, EU, NATO, and Israel, so that it could be, quote unquote, authentic voice and leader in the region. That has not happened. Turkey has not only not become a leader, but it also has lost all of its friends in the West and all its friends in the region. Its only ally in the Middle East right now is Qatar. The country has never been this isolated. Its four major non-European neighbors, Russia, Iran, Iraq, and Syria, are now in an alliance against Turkey. This also has not never happened. And this is a direct result of Turkey's failed policy in Syria, executed by Erdogan and Davutoğlu together. But now, without Davutoğlu, I think Erdogan will try to pivot back to the country's traditional allies in the West, with NATO, with the United States, but also with Israel, where there's talks of normalization going on. So expect this, I think, to be a period when Turkey tries to come closer to its traditional allies in the West that both Davutoğlu and Erdogan thought Turkey could do without for about a decade. The rude awakening for them is that they realize that they can't make Turkey a standalone power. The country's region is full of threats. Turkey's neighbors are not Belgium, Luxembourg, and Netherlands. They are Iran, Iraq, Syria, and Russia. And with neighbors like that, you do need your old friends back.
What's next? Martial law, if he consolidates even more and attempts to really reverse any kind of civil democracy?
The sad part of this for Turkey's democracy is that although Turkey has been a democracy, let's say, longer than has been Spain, Turkey has had free and fair elections, multi-party system since 1950, Erdogan and Davutoğlu have hollowed out Turkey's democratic institutions by consolidating all power in the hands of one person. And now I think the trend, as you said, is hollowing out of Turkey's democratic institutions.
Soner Çayaptay is director of the Turkish Research Program at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. He spoke with us from Washington, D.C. Soner, thanks as always.
My pleasure.
With Turkey's leader looking more and more like a dictator, it makes you wonder if he has set up his golden retirement parachute program like other dictators apparently do with ease. The publication of the Panama Papers earlier this year documented how political leaders find ways to channel national wealth into their own pockets and move it into accounts and assets where it's untouchable. And we can see a wide-scale systematic abuse of the financial system to benefit greedy politicians. But it goes way beyond that. A deeper investigation into nations in the developing world finds that money taken by dictators and thieves in 149 developing countries since 1970, locked away in offshore accounts, adds up to $12.1 trillion. $12.1 trillion in assets that might have financed real investments in those nations rather than buying flashy condos on the Riviera. Jim Henry is a self-described investigative economist who pored over decades of IMF and World Bank data. He now works as a senior advisor at the Tax Justice Network. He's a senior fellow at the Columbia Center for Sustainable Investment. Jim Henry says that 30 countries on the list account for 95% of the total money taken.
What's striking about our list of 30 countries that dominate the $12.1 trillion from the developing world that's offshore is that many of them have no rule of law, no free press, and they're ruled by autocrats. When you look at the list, you see Russia and China right at the top. There's been a huge amount of capital flight pouring out of China in the last 18 months, and our data is as of the end of 2014, there was already $1.6 trillion owned by Chinese residents that was offshore outside of China. So, you know, Russia's total, $1.3 trillion. Saudi Arabia is another big player here. That's obviously not a liberal democracy.
And when you say kleptocrats, you're talking about people who are taking money that would otherwise go to the citizens or projects within particular countries, taking it for themselves, and then funneling it offshore where nobody can take it.
Well, I'm talking about whatever resources they're able to get their hands on. Usually public assets are involved, but also private markets are in these countries are often organized in non-competitive ways. They may have loans from state banks. There's a thousand ways to help yourself to the public treasury if you have influence and power. It's really crony capitalism that we're talking about here.
How much is this $12.1 trillion flowing around the world, a distorter of the global economy? For instance, can you tell whether it operates in cycles, whether capital flight goes up and down according to the business cycle, or is it a result of individual issues within countries, political instability and the like?
There's basically three or four different drivers. Some of it is political instability and being concerned about regime change. Some of it is just pure outright tax dodging, where there's countries that have, like Mexico has an income tax that's being evaded on a massive scale. The global total is really more like 24 to 34 trillion. And this 12.1 trillion is just the share that comes from the developing regions. The rest of it comes from the OECD countries, the rich countries in the world. But I think the world economy is just beginning to appreciate, you know, that this is about 10 to 15% of world wealth, and it's a big deal. It has a dramatic impact on wealth inequality because none of the wealth here is being taxed or, you know, it's really reportable. It's obviously helping dictators stay in power because they don't need to be responsible to their residents. So it really has a lot of negative effects on the world economy.
How much of an impact has this $12.1 trillion coming out of the developing world had? What might have been built that hasn't been? What might have been channeled to citizens hasn't been?
Most of this offshore money is being, I would say, underinvested. It's invested in very low return assets. U.S. Treasury is paying, you know, less than 2% compared to what you might get if you had a, you know, developing countries typically offer 20 to 30 to 40% ROIs on investment there if you can take care of the issues about political risk. And so there's a real opportunity cost to the world. I mean, collectively, the developing regions are a net lender to the first world to the tune of more than $10 trillion. And that's a major hidden cost of the existing system, which really almost dwarfs all of the development aid that we provide. $140 billion a year is, you know, much less than the opportunity cost of investing all this in low return assets offshore.
So an investment in a water system in Iraq or someplace in Africa
which might return 10 or 12%, and supply water to the people of those countries, instead goes into low-income treasury bills, and the people aren't taken care of, and it's just a way of money not working when it ought to.
Yeah, the social returns on investment in developing countries tend to be north of 30%, but, you know, returns on education and healthcare systems and basic infrastructure, roads and highways, capital for those purposes is scarce. Meanwhile, you have kleptocrats basically satisfied with zero rates of return as long as they can maintain the stuff they've stolen. So they're not concerned with the yield. So this is a real pathology in the existing system.
And is there a network for laundering it and infrastructure here?
Well, it's really a global haven industry. What's highlighted by the Panama Papers is that, you know, a lot of the requests for secret offshore trusts and companies were coming from the largest banks in the world, including big players like HSBC and UBS and Credit Suisse. When you look at where the money actually ends up, much of it ends up back in the first world countries, the United States, the UK, and Switzerland. Every dictatorship has its variations, but, you know, lots of states in California, you see the Chinese money flowing into Vancouver, which now has a real estate boom. Ordinary Canadians can't afford to live there anymore. It's a real scandal that we don't really know who owns the real estate in places like New York and London. And the U.S. Treasury is just now beginning to require declarations of beneficial owners for real estate transactions. But there's a lot of work to be done because, you know, that is not self-enforcing. Somebody has to audit the database and make sure that it's properly reported. And it really needs to be public so that everybody can look at who owns it. But even for states like Delaware, we have no idea who owns the more than 1 million companies registered in Delaware. So it's not just an offshore problem. It's also gotten to be an onshore problem.
And you're speaking to me from Florida today?
Yes, I am. Yeah.
You're in Miami?
I'm in North Palm Beach.
In North Palm Beach, in some rich condo owned by some nameless Saudi prince somewhere, and you have no idea who built it or what?
No, it's actually a house that I own with my girlfriend.
And you're surrounded by Eastern European dictators in gigantic palaces?
Not at this particular place. No, all my neighbors are working middle class. No, there is a gated community kind of Florida. So I've seen kind of the two ways of living here, the extreme societies that are based on healthy middle class, a lot of citizenship involvement, community spirit, and the other extreme where, you know, you have a lot of people who are just left out. I definitely think we should prefer the former.
James Henry, thanks so much.
Great to be here.
What my dad did yesterday? Blew my whole set. I'm telling you.
Poor Machi Demoriaku, this 18-year-old girl from the South Bronx, has a hard time when her dad goes into school to meet her health science class teacher, and to Machi's horror, gives the teacher an assignment.
And your assignment is to check up with her every single day. See if her teeth are clean, if her hair is good, if her body odor is okay, if her clothes are properly ironed.
That is the Machi Demoriaku of YouTube telling stories about her controlling Nigerian parents. There is also the Machi Demoriaku actress and comedian hoping to go to college next year. There is proper young Nigerian woman Machi, proud but confused American daughter of traditional parents Machi, hip-hop Machi, American teenager Machi. All those personalities thrive in an era of Facebook and smartphones, Snapchat and Instagram, and they represent a choir of storytellers for the approximately 80 million first- and second-generation immigrants in the United States today. Our friend Machi Demoriaku is a senior at Dreamyard Preparatory School in the South Bronx, and her many identities are a portfolio of freedom and a 21st-century pioneer's snapshot of American history.
I was born in America, but my family comes from Nigeria. A lot of the times, I am always in like this shift between whenever I go back home, I'm considered African-American. But whenever I'm over here, it's like, oh yeah, you were born here, but your family's from Africa. It's from the motherland, the mother country. So I always had like that hard sense of like, where do I come from? I'm stuck in the middle between these two worlds. And it wasn't until ninth grade that I really like finally like stood up for myself. And it was in my black box theater in my ninth grade classroom. And there was this one boy stood up, just randomly started violating all the Africans, like calling them like names that you just hear from any day on the street. And before anybody said anything to stop him, I stood up and I looked him straight in the eye and said, "Don't violate my people." when I said that, I felt like a release from all the tension that I felt for over the years of being this Oreo cream stuck in the middle. Now I'm more often able to say my name, like the name that was on my birth certificate, my full name. I've been able to just allow myself to be myself.
So you're Machi today, but who were you then?
I was Victoria, Veronica, Vanessa.
How is Victoria different from Machi?
Victoria was very, I wouldn't say a wild child. She definitely did not care at all what other people thought. And she did her own thing on her own rules and terms. And yeah, she was very, like, wild.
And Machi?
Very calm, sometimes very shy, closed off to society more often.
Proper Nigerian daughter?
No.
No.
I was as proper as I could be, but mm-hmm. there were still parts of me just like, there's some things I'm not going to do.
Why is storytelling so important for you, given the story of your family?
It gives me the voice that not a lot of people in my situation get. It allows me to tell a story to tell things about my life that not a lot of people get to hear. And my experiences kind of help other people to tell their own stories and be expressive and open in telling their own.
Is it hard to be an immigrant in America, do you think?
Yes, it is very hard to be one because at a point you are from this country that you love and care about deeply, but you are also beginning to understand the different parts of this new world, and people don't like you in this new world because they think that you should go back to where you belong.
Who says that?
In my case, other fellow first generations and sometimes people who have been here for like years, for like many generations.
So immigrants compete. In other words, the people who came in before don't necessarily want new people coming in.
Yeah.
You feel that?
Yeah, most of the time.
You're also a part of a black experience that's not American. It's a African experience.
Yes.
Do you notice that difference in your interactions with people and with popular culture?
I see that difference a lot. It's almost every day. I'm like going to school. Or I'm like with my friends. Like whenever we're talking about like how our families grew up, like all of my friends talk about how their parents like grew up over here during the times in America when it was like
civil rights.
Yes. Yeah. Like, and when I talk about my family experience, sometimes it's considered funny because my parents had like a completely different experience back home, Nigeria, than people who were born and raised over here.
It seems that your school has been a real place for you to experience being an immigrant because there are so many people who are either having the experience that you're having or not having the experience that you're having. What does that mean?
Most of my school is either first generation or second generation. And at first, there was kind of like a real divide between like all the students of color, the black students and the Spanish students. But like over the years, we've really, through like the help of like the teachers and the principal, like they've like really forced us to become, not forced us, we chose to be, really become a community and like to accept each other for all of our differences. There's just still minor problems that go on as a teenager. Like we all have our own family problems, but like in my school, I feel like you can go to a teacher and you can talk to them about how you feel, and you can let them in on like your life story, mm-hmm. and like you wouldn't feel shunned or hated. And a lot of my classmates really are like respectful to me when it comes to that stuff, and I'm respectful to them as much as I can.
Well, Machi, it's great to talk to you. Good luck in your performance.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
You take care. Machi Dumoriaku is a senior at Dreamyard Preparatory School in the South Bronx. She'll be performing her story at a Young Immigrants in the Big Apple event live tonight in the Green Space at WNYC. To stream it live or to find out more, visit thegreenspace.org. And here's something to take with you today. It might be bad news. I mean, Those of you confused about your proud European identity in the face of all the political troubles on the continent can now feel content or outraged over the latest DNA analysis of modern Europeans. It seems that when the Ice Age ended between 12 and 15,000 years ago, the humans in Europe were all in one place before wandering far and wide. When modern European history began, DNA researchers using new search tools at the Harvard Medical School say that all of today's Europeans came from a founder group huddled in a place in North Central Europe, a place that would someday be called, look, it's science, folks, a place called Belgium. That's right. Eurosports, Franco, German, Britallians, you're all just Belgians. Belgians. So in this Eurozone problem, you really can't all get along. Remember, you can take us with you. Subscribe to our podcast. You can find us on iTunes. Take us with you on your commute home from work. A great way to stay up on the news. Again, find us on iTunes or any other service you use to get your podcast. That means you, all you Euro-Belgians out there. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society, funding research so patients do more than survive, they live their lives. Learn more at lls.org. From Lumosity, offering a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving, with brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a brain training program. Performance can be compared with global averages. Learn more at lumosity.com. Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.